Have you ever like looked in the mirror and been like, whoa, those are totally my dad's eyes?
Or been amazed by that friend, you know, the one who can tan like a lizard in the sun while you're slathering on the SPF 50.
Well, get ready because today we're diving deep, and I mean deep, into the world of genetics.
To explore how these tiny molecules basically make us us, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's wild.
So we've got some excerpts from this like seriously in-depth biology textbook.
And let me tell you, we're about to uncover some really cool stuff about what makes you, you. From like a genetic standpoint
See,
anywhere.
this stuff is really mind-blowing once you start peeling back the layers.
Okay, so you're the expert here. Hit me with the basics. What exactly do we mean when we talk about genes and DNA and all that?
Okay, so think of your genes like an instruction manual, right?
Okay, with you.
But not just any instruction manual. It's this incredibly detailed blueprint that guides like the construction of you.
Okay, hold on. How detailed are we talking? Like, is this one of those massive blueprints architects use or what?
Think bigger, way bigger.
Yeah.
If you took all the DNA in just one of your cells and like stretched it out, it would reach, get this, about 6 feet.
No way. Seriously.
And then multiply that by the trillions of cells in your body. We're talking a strand of DNA that could stretch to the sun and back multiple times.
Whoa. Okay. That's way more impressive than any blueprint I've ever seen. But how does all that DNA, all those instructions, actually like tell our bodies what to do?
Right. So that's where our genes come in.
They're like specific chapters in this massive instruction manual, right?
Okay. Like that analogy. Keep going.
Each gene or chapter contains the code for building a specific protein. And those proteins, they're the real MVPs. They do everything from like digesting your food to, you know, making sure your heart beats.
So genes are the blueprints, proteins are the builders, got it. But are there parts of our DNA that are just like, I don't know, blank pages, parts that don't really do anything?
Well, you know, for a while, scientists, they thought so. They even called these sections of DNA between genes junk DNA, like literally junk.
Junk DNA. That's kind of harsh, isn't it?
I know, right? But here's the thing. We're starting to realize that this so-called junk DNA might be way more important than we thought.
Really? Like, what? Spill the tea? What's all this junk actually doing?
So imagine like a dimmer switch, right?
Okay, got it.
It can control how bright or dim a light is. Well, some of this non-coding DNA, it acts like a dimmer switch for our genes, controlling how active they are.
So it's not just the genes themselves, but also how they're like controlled that makes us who we are.
Exactly. It's like an orchestra, and the junk DNA is the conductor, making sure everything runs smoothly.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So we've got these genes, these instructions, but we know we don't all look the same. What makes me different from, say, you or someone, you know, on the other side of the world?
Well, that comes down to tiny variations in our DNA sequence. We call them polymorphisms. Think of them like spelling changes in the genetic code.
Okay, and everyone has these spelling changes.
Pretty much. In fact, there are millions of them scattered throughout the human genome.
Millions. For real.
For real. And that's a good thing. It's what makes each of us unique, like a fingerprint, but on a DNA level.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've got these genes, these polymorphisms, but how do they actually lead to like the traits we see? You know, like eye color, height, all that.
Okay, let's use blood type as an example because it's kind of simple and clear.
All right, I'm listening.
So, whether your blood type is A, B, AB, or O, it all depends on this one gene called the ABO gene.
And everyone has this ABO gene.
Yep, everyone inherits one copy from their mom and one from their dad.
Okay, so where do the different blood types come in?
So, there are different versions of this ABO gene, and each version codes for a slightly different protein that basically determines which sugars are on the surface of your red blood cells.
So it's like different variations of the same instruction.
Exactly. And that's a pretty straightforward example of how your genotype, the genes you inherit, directly affects your phenotype, the traits you actually have.
Okay, so one gene, one trait. That makes sense, but I'm guessing it gets more complicated than that.
Oh, you have no idea. Take height, for example.
Okay, yeah, good example.
It's not just one gene that determines how tall you are, but potentially hundreds, maybe even thousands, each doing their own little thing to contribute to your final height.
So it's like a team effort with tons of genes working together.
Exactly. And then on top of that, you've got environmental factors like, you know, nutrition.
Right, the whole nature versus nurture thing.
Always. It's never one or the other, you know, but this crazy interplay between your genes and your environment.
Okay, so We've got our instruction manual, we've got our genes, we've got all these variations, and even some of that mysterious junk DNA doing its thing. But what happens if there's like a typo in those instructions? You know, a mutation.
Mutations are actually, they're fascinating. They're the engine of genetic variation, introducing all sorts of new changes to our DNA.
Well, I always thought mutations were like a bad thing.
Well, they can be, but not always. Think of it like adding a pinch of spice to a recipe.
I like where you're going with this.
Sometimes that spice, it'll ruin the whole dish.
Been there.
But other times, it might add this whole new depth of flavor.
Okay, I see your point. So some mutations are bad, some are good, and I'm guessing some are just like, meh.
Exactly. They can be beneficial, harmful, or have basically no effect at all.
So how do these mutations happen? Like, what causes them in the first place?
Well, our DNA is constantly making copies of itself, you know, especially when cells divide.
Right.
And while it's usually super accurate, every now and then, little errors slip through.
Well, kind of like when you're, I don't know, copying and pasting something a bunch of times and accidentally delete a word or two.
Exactly. Those little errors, those are mutations. And they can happen spontaneously or, you know, they can be triggered by things like exposure to certain chemicals or radiation.
Radiation. So, like, are we talking about, you know, superpowers and stuff?
Not quite.
Okay, good, because I don't think I could handle superpowers right now.
But it is true that high levels of radiation can be dangerous and can lead to mutations.
Makes sense. I'm guessing we're exposed to at least some radiation on a regular basis, right?
Yeah, actually we are. We're constantly exposed to low levels of radiation from things like cosmic rays.
Cosmic rays. Sounds kind of intense.
It's true. And even some rocks emit low levels of radiation.
Really? Rocks.
Yeah. But don't worry, our bodies are pretty amazing.
Okay, that's reassuring.
We've evolved to repair most of the damage from this everyday exposure to low-level radiation.
Okay, good to know. So we've got these mutations popping up, creating different versions of genes. But how do those changes get passed down through generations?
And how does that lead to, like, you know, all the incredible diversity of life we see around us?
Yeah, those are great questions. And that's where things get really, truly fascinating. That's where the forces of evolution come into play.
Okay, so last time we were in the middle of talking about these mutations, these little genetic typos, and I'm still wrapping my head around how those typos turn into, like, you know, the whole evolution of life as we know it. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's easy to get tripped up in the details, but it's helpful to remember that not every mutation gets a free pass to the next generation.
So it's not like every typo gets published.
Precisely. Think of it more like a competition, where only those mutations that give an organism an edge tend to stick around.
Okay, so survival of the fittest mutations. But what makes a mutation advantageous in the, like, grand scheme of things?
Well, imagine, let's say, a population of moths in a forest, right?
Okay, moths, got it.
Now, let's say some of these moths have a mutation that makes their wings a bit lighter than the others.
Okay, so we've got some light-winged moths and some with, like, regular wings.
Right. Now, imagine the trees in this forest have really light-colored bark.
Ah, I see where you're going with this. The lighter moths would blend in better.
Exactly. They're better camouflaged, which means they're less likely to end up as, you know, bird food.
So they're more likely to survive, have little moth babies, and pass on those light-wing genes.
Precisely. And over time, that process can lead to some pretty big changes.
Like the whole moth population ending up with lighter wings.
Exactly. That's natural selection doing its thing.
Survival of the fittest, or in this case, the best camouflaged. But I think our source also mentioned that evolution isn't always about, like, being the strongest or fastest, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Sometimes it's about being the best fit for a very specific niche, like finding a unique way to, you know, thrive in your environment.
Yeah, like finding your people, but for moths.
Exactly. And to understand how those niches get filled, we got to talk about the different flavors of natural selection.
Flavors. Okay, I'm intrigued. Hit me with these evolutionary flavors.
Well, our source mentioned three main types: stabilizing selection, directional selection, and this one's a mouthful, disruptive selection.
Okay, let's break them down. Stabilizing selection, that sounds kind of, I don't know, chill.
It is,
yeah,
in a way. So picture a population of birds, right?
Yeah.
And let's say the average beak size in this population is perfect for cracking open the most common type of seed in their environment.
Okay, makes sense. The bird's got to eat.
Right. Now, birds with beaks that are too big or too small, they're going to have a harder time getting to the good stuff inside those seeds.
So it's like Goldilocks and the three bears, but with beaks.
Exactly. Stabilizing selection, keep things nice and balanced.
Got it. Average is the way to go. What about directional selection? That sounds a little less stable.
You could say that. Imagine those birds we were talking about, but now their environment changes.
Uh-oh, curveball.
Right. Now a new type of seed, one with a super tough shell, becomes like the main food source.
And those average size beaks aren't cutting it anymore.
Exactly. The birds with slightly bigger, stronger beaks, those are the ones who are suddenly thriving. They can crack those tough seeds, no problem.
So they're out eating and, I'm guessing, out reproducing the other birds.
Got it. And that's how directional selection works. Over time, it pushes the average beak size in a specific direction towards the bigger, stronger beaks.
Okay, that makes sense. It's like the environment gives evolution a little nudge in one direction or another.
Exactly. Now, for the really interesting one, disruptive selection, this is where the extremes on both ends of the spectrum have the advantage.
Okay, I need an example for this one.
All right, picture a population of rabbits.
Rabbits. I like where this is going.
And let's say they live in an environment with a mix of black rocks and white rocks.
Okay, I'm visualizing it. Black rocks, white rocks, rabbits hopping around.
So the rabbits with black fur, they're practically invisible against the black rocks, right?
Right. Camouflage masters.
And the rabbits with white fur, they blend in seamlessly with the white rocks.
But the poor rabbits with, like, gray fur, they stick out like a sore thumb.
Exactly. Predators can easily spot them, making them, well, less likely to stick around.
So in this rabbit utopia, it's best to be either black or white, no in between.
Exactly. That's disruptive selection. It favors those extremes, creating a more diverse population with those two very distinct colors.
Wow. It's amazing how these subtle differences in, like, fur color can have such a big impact on survival.
It really highlights how powerful those seemingly small variations can be. But it's also important to remember that evolution isn't always this straight line from mutation to adaptation.
Right, because life is messy and unpredictable.
Exactly. And sometimes it's those random events, those lucky breaks or unfortunate turns that could really shake things up in the evolutionary game.
Okay, so are we talking about, like, meteor strike wiping out the dinosaurs kind of random events?
Well, that's one example. But even on a smaller scale, there are tons of unpredictable things that can happen. Our source uses the term stochastic processes to describe these random events that influence which genes get passed down.
Stochastic processes. Okay, that sounds a little intimidating.
It's just a fancy way of saying that there's an element of chance involved. Like, imagine a wildfire rips through a forest.
Okay, I'm with you.
Now, let's say there's a group of animals that just happen to be sheltering in a burrow when the fire sweeps through. They survive, while others nearby don't.
So it's not that those animals were, like, inherently better in some way. They were just lucky.
Exactly. They were in the right place at the right time.
And because they survived, their genes, those lucky genes, get to stay in the gene pool.
Right. And that's a great example of how these chance events, these stochastic processes, can have a huge impact on which traits get passed on, especially in smaller populations.
It's almost humbling to think that something as random as a wildfire can influence the course of evolution.
It really is. It shows that even with natural selection guiding the way, there's still room for, you know, a bit of luck and randomness to throw in some surprises.
So we've got mutations, we've got natural selection, and we've got this element of chance.
And we can't forget about how genes get shuffled and rearranged when, you know, organisms reproduce. It's like evolution's way of shuffling the deck with each new generation.
So we've talked about mutations, natural selection, this whole idea of random events shaping evolution, but I feel like we're still missing a piece of the puzzle.
Well, we haven't really talked about sex yet.
Oh, right. Because it's not all about survival, right? We've got to pass those genes on.
Exactly. And that process, that's where things get even more interesting, genetically speaking, anyway.
Okay, because I remember learning in, like, high school biology that we get half of our DNA from our mom and half from our dad. Which explains why we end up looking like, you know, a mix of both.
Exactly. But it's more than just inheriting a set of traits. During the process of, like, creating sperm and egg cells, something really incredible happens.
Okay, I'm listening. Lay it on me.
It's called genetic recombination. Imagine taking those two instruction manuals, the one from your mom and the one from your dad, and, like, ripping out pages at random, then piecing them together to make a brand new manual.
Bro, that's like next level gene mixing.
That's a great way to put it. It creates so much diversity, you know?
So it's not just the genes themselves, but also how they're, like, mixed and matched that makes each of us unique.
Precisely. It's like shuffling a deck of cards.
So every time a sperm fertilizes an egg, it's like dealing out a whole new hand.
Exactly. And that's why, even with billions of people on the planet, no two individuals are exactly alike, unless you're an identical twin, of course.
Mind-blowing. And this whole shuffling process has been going on for, like, millions of years, right?
Oh, yeah, for as long as organisms have been reproducing sexually.
It's kind of poetic when you think about it. All these tiny shuffles and rearrangements, all these chance encounters leading to, you know, all the amazing creatures, even us, that we see today.
It really makes you appreciate how interconnected we all are. You know, we're not just products of our own little family trees, but part of this much larger ancient web of life.
It's like those nature versus nurture debates miss the whole point.
Totally. It's not one or the other, but this constant dance between our genes, our environment, and just plain old luck.
So I guess that answers my question about why I have my dad's eyes, thanks to a little genetic shuffling, a dash of natural selection, and maybe a sprinkle of cosmic coincidence.
Exactly. It's a recipe billions of years in the making.
Well, you know what they say. It's in your DNA. But seriously, this has been amazing. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive into the world of genetics and evolution.
Anytime. It's fascinating stuff, and there's still so much more to learn.
And on that note, we'll leave you to ponder the mysteries of your own genetic inheritance. Until next time.